Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Many people query Zeta Talk about how to differentiate good-hearted people from users, takers, after the pole shift. They envision survival camps, close friends and family, and here comes people walking up to the camp. Should they invite them in? Should they share? Should they trust? Or are these people to be asked to move along? You don't want to mistreat good-hearted people that are going to be staunch allies and help you at the same time and be unfair to them. At the same time, you don't want to open yourself up to being robbed or murdered, and certainly in the meantime, just used by someone who's a basic taker. How can you tell the difference? I'll give you an example, an email from Tex, who writes, on the question of discernment of people's motives and agendas, it reminds me of a time when I lived in a commune in the late 60s. No drugs, and the core group were really more interested in sorting out problems and helping each other figure out things. We were young. We had lots of surprise visitors from cities to our wilderness house by the sea. Friends who told friends who told friends. Usually 20 would show up for meals and never lift a finger to help maintain the place, not even to wash a dish. They always brought sleeping bags and flopped on the property or on the floor. We had a leader, a benevolent dictator, who would approach them after 3 days of being guests. He would tell them that if they liked it so much here and wanted to stay, they would need to do chores like the rest of us. He would point outside to a weed-infested garden space. Start there, he would say, and they would be gone before sundown. The garden space was never weeded just in case it was needed for this reason. It's the end of the quote from Tex. Well, this is an example of what people fret about. After the pole shift, it's going to be even more crucial because a small survival community is vulnerable to being looted, for instance, by gangs, and you wouldn't want people floating through and staying for days and then leaving in case word would get around just where that survival community was and how vulnerable those good-hearted people were. So before I get into a discussion on how to discern good-hearted people from those who will take advantage of you in the aftertime, let's step back and discuss how people arrived at being good-hearted or users in the first place here on Earth. How do souls come to be? Incarnations occur naturally, per the Zetas, even into plants and animals. But unless the physical body is capable of consciousness, being aware of itself as unique, separate from others, as humans are, a soul is simply not sparked. Once sparked, reincarnations also occur naturally. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Incarnations. Incarnations occur naturally and is the way souls get their start. The stuff of souls is everywhere, dispersed throughout the universe, but so dispersed it does not make a soul. Does a single strand of DNA constitute life? Well, yes and no. By itself, it is a complex chemical, but when combined with other DNA in a living organism, it is considered life. The stuff of souls tends to gather in living things, as the environment is more interesting than non-living environments. It is not so much attracted to life, is that it lingers, and thus begins to accumulate. Without conscious intelligence, it fails to establish a personality, a self, and after death of the life form, disperses again. Since incarnations are natural, When the forming entity, or soul, is guided to a new body, it sets up housekeeping willingly. This is a familiar experience. Burning issues that were present when the soul left its former home, a dead or dying body, come to the fore, and the forming soul is off again on the great exploration that life provides. Being incarnated is far more stimulating and fascinating than the alternative, being disincarnate at this stage. And this was end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Incarnations, written December 15, 1995. For an incarnation to spark a soul, consciousness must be present. This is defined as the ability to see others as separate from the self, so that interaction can occur. This is different from the interaction that is driven by instinct, as animals have. I quote from Zeta Talk, Being Conscious. To spark, the biological entity must have the capacity to envision itself as separate. And where many animals seem to have this trait, they do not. A dog will understand that it is being yelled at by its master or snarled at by the leader of the pack, and by groveling and crawling away is indicating they seem to understand another has interacted with them as a separate being. But this is instinctive activity. This is not a discernment of separate biological entities. The dog has evolved to react in such a manner, to challenge until certain signs are present, then to submit. Instinct is not consciousness. Biologically programmed reactions are not consciousness. And this is the end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Being Conscious, written July 15, 2002. The spirit form, something the Zetas call the stuff of souls, transcends the physical and does not die once sparked. The soul gains mass and size during its many incarnations, becoming wise and massive eventually. It basically gains the stuff of souls to it, incorporates it into the soul body, and becomes more massive. An old soul. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Spirit Substance. What humans refer to as the soul, what is sometimes called the spirit, is not what is supposed by most humans. The soul has substance and grows in bulk early in its development as many incarnations, many lives are experienced. This bulk cannot be gauged by humans who look upon one another as having equal souls when nothing of the kind is the reality. Some souls are so tiny and poorly constructed that they dissipate after the first incarnation, what we term aborted entities. This type of soul may be present in many animals and even some plant forms, as the stuff of souls is dispersed through the universe and incarnations happen naturally. Where the human eye cannot gauge the mass of another soul, the spirits gauge this very well. You know instinctively that another is old and wise. Spiritual growth occurs most rapidly early on via incarnations, but later this growth proceeds based on experiences outside of incarnations, and incarnations are not needed for this purpose. The soul not only has memory, it does not forget. It is not by accident that intelligent life forms have nerves, brains, and memory in the form of chemical impressions. It is not by accident that the same structure is found for intelligent thought through all density levels. It is intrinsic to the way the universe is structured, and thus souls likewise have such structures. The stuff of souls permeates all levels where matter can reside. Intelligent life forms come in many shapes and sizes, but all have brains and nerves. Thus, a soul can incarnate in a hominoid at one point in its development, and into quite another life form during another incarnation, without any adaptation required. The soul does not require food or nourishment as physical life forms do. The only outside reach required is to access more of the stuff of souls present everywhere in the universe when growth in bulk is occurring. End of this long quote from Zeta Talk, Spirit Substance, written March 15, 1996. What is this about a young soul being either sparked so that it takes shape and continues, or aborted? What does it take for a young soul, a virgin soul, experiencing its first incarnation, to spark? I quote from Zeta Talk, Spark. Unsparked souls are fuzzy, aware of themselves as separate entities from other humans or animals, but basically dazed and wandering about, gape-mouthed. They are taking it all in as the first passage, the first tour, the first time visiting a place. Unless some matter occurs to spark a soul, such as empathy for another in distress and a choice to sacrifice comfort of the self to assist the other, no sparking occurs. A lazy life lived in a locale indolent with simple tasks or taken out by early childhood illness will not spark. There is a greater percentage of unsparked souls in those continents or locales where life is a simple struggle, not industrialized, not in high communication with other cultures. Thus, third world countries have a higher percentage of unsparked souls. Thus, rural areas have a higher percentage of unsparked souls than urban areas. Thus, the corridors of power almost invariably have older souls, as this is deemed high drama. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Spark, written June 15, 2002. And an abortion? This is not something done to the young soul, but a natural occurrence, and most young souls abort without being sparked, per the Zetas. It is the sparked souls which will reincarnate, which are the exception at the start. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Aborted Entities. Does it happen that an incarnation in an intelligent species does not result in a formed soul? The spark is not lit, and after death, dissipation occurs. Souls spark or do not, and mostly do not, in a virgin incarnation. The stuff of souls gathers in a conscious being because it finds the environment interesting. Some formation occurs during the incarnation, but if the life has not been challenging, then it has not massed, and is prone to dissipation upon the death of the human. Once formed, however, souls do not dissipate. Failure to form is due to a lazy or indolent lifestyle, lack of native intelligence, or lack of stimulation. In this regard, the challenging, stressful life is a benefit rather than a drawback. Challenge can be viewed as puzzles to be solved, or very emotional situations, or situations requiring much determination. Thus, a child crippled, determined to continue his role in the group, will be working a puzzle, a challenge that requires mental work as well as emotional accompaniment. At times, the soul sparks in a virgin incarnation when the human is old, is longing to help young mothers and their infants, but barely able to do so because of infirmity. At other times, as in the crippled child, the opportunity for sparking comes early and strengthens throughout the life. As we have stated, being born beautiful and having a life without cares is not the strongest motivator for spiritual growth. And this was a quote from Zeta Talk, Aborted Entities, written December 15, 1995. Earth is a world where souls are sparked, and thus is a schoolhouse for the early lessons, a type of kindergarten. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Incarnations. The first lessons to be learned are to develop a concept of the self, a concept of the other, and to form an attitude toward relationships with others. End quote from Incarnations, written December 15, 1995. Lessons. First lessons. How do we get along with each other? What's our approach going to be? Are we going to be caring or self-focused? Thus, the birth of good and evil. Our stay on Earth, our first stop after soul birth when the soul is sparked, requires a decision, that decision. Are we going to become empathetic and caring or to stay self-focused? The babe, the newborn babe, is self-focused. It's not aware of other people. It's aware that its diaper is dirty or it needs to be fed. This is not talking about souls, but as an example of young versus old, the babe is naturally self-focused and not empathetic. Those who choose to be self-focused, to remain selfish in an infantile state, are simply not growing. Like newborns, they remain focused solely on themselves. This is the basis of self-centeredness, sadism, a need for control, i.e. evil, the basis of what the Zetas call a service to self entity or soul. They're serving themselves in the main, and truly hardened service to self souls think of others only about 5% of the time and 95% about themselves. And they can be charming, and they can be very well disguised, but the key to that is what is their motive and what actions result in. You can tell people by their actions, but we're going to get into more of that later, how you discern if somebody is essentially selfish. The Zetas call those souls who have chosen caring for others, like basically practicing the golden rule, as service to others, as they are serving others at least 50% of the time. It's not total concern about others and total disregard for the self, because we do have to care about ourselves or we won't stay alive. We do have to look out for ourselves. Service to other, or practicing the golden rule, does not mean that you just think not of yourself at all and let yourself starve to death, for instance, or allow yourself to be a rug mat and not stick up for yourself. Difficult to discern service to self or service to other. Difficult for many people to figure out how to discern. And in an attempt to help with this, the Zetas have written quite a bit about how to discern. What are the key characteristics, caring versus selfishness, and how can you discern this? And I quote from Zeta Talk, key characteristics. There is a common misunderstanding that service to others is all bleeding heart concern, and that service to self is snarling greed. Nothing could be further from the truth. These animals come in various sizes and shapes. One must look for the key characteristics, in fact, to even identify them. An example, look to ourselves. We are service to other Zetas. Do we not defend ourselves? Do we not have particular goals we press? Do we lie down and let others walk all over us? Yet we are concerned for the general welfare and work hard to improve this for ourselves as well as others. Likewise, the service to self are often misunderstood. As we have mentioned, they can be charming and diplomatic. The key is the goal, not the goal stated, which may be packaged to appeal to those to be duped, but the actual goal. A reduction in pollution laws, packaged as enabling employers to stay in business, is in fact a power play by those who resent any restrictions on their power. The unemployment rate has nothing to do with this, but is waved about as a reason. Wives are familiar with the common husband excuse for late hours and avoidance of home chores. The job requires this, and the wife should bear in mind who is slaving away to bring home the bacon. In sum, the service to others individual may be gruff, distracted, disheveled, and inaccessible. But what are they working toward? How do they react when a truth test comes, where they must be willing to sacrifice themselves for others? Do they come through? And the service to self individual may be suave, seemingly generous, even defending others. But when their welfare is lined up against another, when they must truly share and words are to be asked to be replaced by actions, what then? This is the end of Zeta Talk, Key Characteristics, written July 15, 1995. I think we have an excellent example in service to self in the Iraq War. The reasons for going to war were to defend America and to liberate Iraq. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was to go after the oil fields. And here we have hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, children in the main, maiming our soldiers, far more than the numbers announced, because we're hearing it's four times as many, and soldiers just bulldozed into mass graves, because if they weren't U.S. citizens but mercenaries, such as people with green cards, then they weren't even considered a soldier to be reported as dead. And all this for oil. And yet, what are we told? Liberty. You know, we're liberating the Iraqi people. We're defending the American people against terrorism. When Iraq had nothing to do with what happened on 9/11 to the World Trade Center. That's a clear-cut example of service to self lies the facade, the suave facade. So the Zetas are saying that actions are the key. How the individual acts when the chips are down, or acts in general. Not what the words are, but what the actions portray. Since a facade can be so easily worn by the selfish, the Zetas have given some examples on how to discern. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Distinguishing Characteristics. A great deal of confusion reigns regarding the spiritual orientations and how to determine whether someone is leaning in this direction or that. Key characteristics may come into play when the chips are down, but this is seldom the situation, and most of a life allows the true orientation to be masked by personality, subterfuge, or such structured situations that the orientation of the individuals does not have an opportunity to express. Take the example of an office setting where assignments are meted out to individuals, but teamwork is stressed. To the manager, the extroverted young man recently hired may seem to be doing more than his share, at least to hear him talk, as he has many stories detailing how his expertise or enthusiasm for challenge came to the rescue of the group. But check with the individual members of the team, and one learns the reverse is true, as he was the one who required rescuing and feigned ignorance until other members of the long-suffering team did his work for him. When he gets a raise and a nod, the team is puzzled, as it would not occur to them to report him to the manager for taking more than he is giving. They considered him in need of help, a youth in need of guidance, and took him under their wings. This type of going behind the back and taking credit is a frequent sign that the individual is operating primarily in the service to self or is headed in that direction. Take an example in the military, where soldiers train and then suddenly find themselves on the front lines in conflict. During training exercises, the officers in charge can be led greatly astray by bravado in safe and controlled exercises. Those individuals who excelled, exhorted their fellows to greater efforts, and who showed leadership are assumed to be doing the same thing in battle. Yet more often than not, it is the quiet soldier who made no efforts to take the spotlight who must step into the fray and assume true leadership position. This is de facto leader, and he may find himself put into danger deliberately so the leader with the title can take credit afterwards. Dead men tell no tales, and the record in combat stands at odds with the awards and promotions, so any rumors are discounted. Placing someone else in danger to retain a title or position is a strong sign of an individual in the service to self, and rarely occurs unless the individual has made their orientation decision. Take the example of a nurse, required by law and the rules of the hospital where she works to maintain life in her patients, regardless of the level of unremitting pain they are experiencing or the pleas they may be laying before her. She has at risk her job, her status, her ability to support her family financially, and most certainly her freedom should she be prosecuted under the law. But she determines to listen to those pleas. Certain medications that sustain the living dead, the rising mass of agony that is in a certain death march, are flushed down the toilet rather than forced into the arm of the patient. Who is to know? Most certainly the patient, who can barely speak except to whisper please, will not complain. This type of risk-taking, when there is utterly no benefit to the self, but rather great risk to the self, is a strong sign of an individual in the service to others. Take the example of children in a household where the mother is ill, chronically so, and the children expected to assume her responsibilities. The father works long and hard and has no patience with chores undone. Some of the younger children need help with their chores, especially as they fail to watch the clock and can be caught rushing to do them when father walks in. The oldest is a girl who herself slips her chores to her younger siblings, leaving them half done, so it's not clear who was inattentive. If this girl is to dry and put away the dishes, but another child is to set the table, she places the dried dishes on the table rather than into the cupboard, confusing the issue. That her little brother gets whipped for putting too many dishes out of the cupboard bothers her not. She thinks of hairstyles and makeup and meeting the night boy at the mall. The chips can fall where they may. This type of lack of concern for others can be attributed to inattention, but where one has seen a sibling whipped and can anticipate this in the future, it is not inattention, but lack of regard, a sure sign of an individual oriented to themselves in the service to self. In this same example, one of the younger children, a boy, does half the chores for two of his siblings. He works with them, showing them how to do the chores, and in this way not only makes sure the chores are done, but are done to the exacting father's measure. In this, he doesn't take credit for the chores, but praises his siblings. He also gives up after-school games and parties to ensure that his siblings aren't caught with poorly done chores. Knowing the father is awash in fatigue and worry and can take all of this out on the household if given half an excuse. This boy, still only a child himself, is giving evidence of his strong orientation in the service to others. The characteristics are not only that he is helping others, but that he seeks to make them strong and self-sufficient and will sacrifice his own pleasure to ensure that others do not suffer. And this is the end of a lengthy quote from Zeta Talk, Distinguishing Characteristics, written May 15, 1996. When the souls born on Earth are ready to leave their first schoolhouse, the planet Earth, they must be separated according to their spiritual orientation. This is because the selfish, the service to self, if given more technology like spaceships and higher IQs, would use it to take advantage of their good-hearted neighbors. They're essentially sent off to reform school to live with each other. Those who have been able to take advantage of others on Earth, in our kindergarten, which has been kind of hands-off, we're allowed to just hack at each other and learn by our actions and the actions of others until we've made our decision here in our kindergarten playpen. So those who have been able to take advantage of others in this kindergarten playpen suddenly find themselves reincarnated in what the Zetas have termed hell, where they must live among each other with their like kind and have no one to take advantage of. Everyone lying and selfish and sadistic, 95% thinking of themselves, and what a hell that must be. Heaven, of course, is where the caring and empathetic have only others of a like mind around them, what Jesus described as 1,000 years of peace when he would return and the meek would inherit the earth. That's heaven. Heaven and hell are truly of our own making. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Leveling Wars. Within the service to self, an all-out battle for supremacy occurs when superiority is not clear. Both want to be top dog, and the ruling masters are willing to send in and sacrifice their minions. This situation needs no explanation, as human wars are equivalent in most respects. Warfare in human history has been as brutal as the restraints on the warlords will allow. They want at their command virtual killing machines who have no remorse or hesitation. But what human warlords most often get are procrastinating generals and deserting troops, even when the mission can be cloaked in humanitarian terms. Soldiers hesitate to kill, and generals hope for compromise or a bloodless capitulation. But what if there were no reluctance or hesitation? As where there is no remorse, one does not hesitate. What if the warlords on both sides had their perfect soldiers? Put this emotional climate into the high-tech arena that exists after graduation from spiritual kindergarten, and what follows is a service-to-self leveling war. It has called us, as this is the result, the survivors ultimately finding their level in relationships to the other groups, with one standing above the other. In these wars, the soldiers are not motivated out of loyalty or a commitment to ideals. They are all like gladiators, kill or be killed. A soldier who refuses to be the perfect killing machine for his master is made an example, and a quick and painless death is out of the question. Human wars see the use of biological weapons such as nerve gas, nuclear bombs, maiming devices such as mines, psychological weapons such as reminders of home and comfort, and various wearing techniques such as starvation. Intergalactic wars between the service-to-self groups are more brutal and direct, with complete destruction in the wink of an eye, the goal. Thus, the service-to-self groups, when establishing their pecking order, frequently brutalize and decimate each other, just as establishing the pecking order within the service-to-self group results in brutality and maiming, if not death. The pecking order is thus established and maintained with the same heavy-handed methods, so that a visitor to service-to-self camps would think it remarkably peaceful, not seeing what came before. All is peaceful again until some factor or other changes the power structure. All this is viewed from afar by service to other groups who are aware of the battles, but as they cannot be affected, essentially disinterested. And this was a quote from Zeta Talk Leveling Wars, written May 15, 1996. Here we have a description of the essential hell that those who have decided to be self-focused almost entirely go to when they leave their kindergarten environment. In kindergarten, they were able to bonk each other over the head with toys, and those who were could be taken advantage of could freely be taken advantage of. Essentially, a hands-off environment, non-interference, playpen, where the children are to learn how to get along with each other and make their decision whether they want to be bullies or helpmates with each other. But when they leave this kindergarten setting, they go into heaven or hell and have to live with their own kind. So this is an example of what goes on in hell, and not to be envied. Sometimes the service to self seem to be on top of things, ruling companies, running companies, getting themselves into political power, being bullies in the schoolyard, but in the end, they do not win. Meanwhile, those finding themselves in heaven on a caring and empathetic world where everyone is like this, they find many of the constraints they lived under in the past removed. And I quote from Zeta Talk, without money. Money is non-existent in service to other communities beyond kindergarten. Let us explain why this would be so. What is money? A medium of exchange, something of consistent value, or at least stable value, which allows the barter system to take place on a more abstract manner. If one grows and markets apples, for instance, they do not have to haul around a bag of apples in order to purchase milk or pay the rent, although this option is still open to the apple grower. Without money, the apple grower must haul apples about, and this is tiresome, and such matters as spoilage must be dealt with. However, the existence of money, which has been called the root of all evil, supports activity that give no value in and of themselves. What benefit, truly, are the virtual gambling casinos that go by names such as stock exchange, commodity market, or bond market? This benefits those who can accumulate faster, manipulate faster, or with a more clever sleight of hand, but benefits the overall not one whit. These activities are, in fact, parasitic on the overall, as the operators must be fed and housed, yet contribute nothing. Often, in fact, they benefit at the expense of the very people who should benefit, those who produce. The principal beneficiaries of money gambling arenas are those already wealthy, who hire clever gamblers, and who in the main stop at nothing to succeed. The laws governing this activity do not stop lies, theft, or evasion of regulation. This is due to the pressure and inducements that the wealthy place on legislatures. The little guy loses again. So how do service to other societies function without money, a medium of exchange? Money is used to indicate to others what the individual has earned or has a right to spend. However, money is presented, whether cash, a line of credit, a credit card with a balance under the credit limit, antiques or jewelry with an appraised value, real estate with an appraised value, all indicate that the holder can spend or exchange goods to this amount. What this also means is that without such proof of worth, the individual cannot spend and is on charity. At this point, the individual gets free food and lodging from either the government or charitable organizations, or goes on the street as so many do. For simplicity's sake, you can consider service to others as operating as though everyone were a charity case. We will be explicit. The apple grower, when in need of some other item than the apples he grows, simply goes and takes them. Likewise, others simply come and take apples as needed. If there are too few apples, then there is a distress communicated telepathically, and a meeting of the group is called. Or perhaps the issue has come up during the regular meetings. As there is distress, others in the group weigh their current activities in light of the new need and discuss alternatives. Essentially, someone who may be on sabbatical in order to devote to learning may cut this short to assist. Or someone who has taken responsibility for doing laundry may find they have extra time on their hands and volunteer. Or it may be that in weighing the activities of all, the conclusion of the group is that apples are of less importance and an agreement is reached to parse the existing supply out more carefully. In this way, money is replaced by communication and cooperation, and this works just fine. This is a quote from Zeta Talk Without Money, written July 15, 1995. So where are we on Earth now, present day? Neither in heaven or hell, but in a schoolhouse where young souls are able to make their decisions to be caring or self-focused. In this schoolhouse, there were no rules. The toddlers in the playpen were able to bonk each other over the head with toys. No holds barred, as this is the fastest way to shake out a determination whether you're self-focused or caring for others, whether you'll stand up to defend the weak at risk to yourself or step back and let innocence be savaged, whether you will share only when the good times are there, but when really pressed, you know, to make a sacrifice, whoops, you got to think about yourself. This is the fastest way for these decisions to shake out, and that's what our kindergarten is all about spiritually, our first spiritual lesson. But the school term is going to end shortly because of the coming pole shift, when a massive die-off of 90% of all the Earth's population is expected to occur. This has been administratively scheduled to be a transformation period for the Earth because of this pole shift, which is a natural event. It's a type of graduation, and the good-hearted will remain on Earth, will reincarnate on Earth, a time that Jesus describes as the meek inheriting the Earth. The highly selfish, service to self, will be hauled off to reform school. And the majority of souls on Earth who are young and haven't really firmed up that decision which way they're going to go will be taken elsewhere to another world that is a kindergarten to complete their deliberations. But this transformation takes some time, as each human is allowed to live out their lifetime to complete their current incarnation. In the meantime, due to the pending separation of the spiritual orientations, which everyone senses is coming, those who are caring or self-serving become increasingly polarized. And this is described well in the Zeta Talk Gradual Change, which I will quote from. Polarization in the main goes on undetected, with humans migrating to areas they sense will be more compatible with their thinking. Humans join groups, decide what shops to shop in, take walks in this or that park, all based on orientation, increasingly. Political groups, religious affiliations, all are affected by orientation leanings. Decisions as to what groups to belong to, what locales to live in, what employer to work for, are made daily based on the sense the human has that their chosen orientation fits in. A group that plays ball hard with ridicule of those losing, and another plays ball for exercise and ensures that all attending get a fair physical workout. A political party is elitist, cruel to those in need and giving increasing power to the strong and ruthless. A church is so rule-oriented that the elders cannot be challenged even when they rape children and refuse to be called to account. At a certain point during a polarization period, these trends are noticed as they become extreme. This is the point reached today, thus noticed. The percentage of service to other on the earth is tipping, and the service to self among humans feel uncomfortable. They group more tightly to be with their kind. They seek more control, get more shrill, dictate more rules, and restrict access to themselves. This is all to increase their comfort level, to return to the comfort level they remember in prior times. This desire for control, to return to the good old days, is what in fact drives the polarization, as the service to self willingly separate. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Gradual Change. What's that about the service to other increasing? This happens because as the earth is to be a home for the service to other in the future, walk-ins are allowed where weak humans with poorly formed souls, confused and upset by increasing earth changes, increasing sense of anxiety that something is around the corner that's horrific for the world, which the pole shift certainly is, wanting to ditch out, wanting to leave, and in essence commit a spiritual suicide. And in that case, the body is allowed to be swapped out, the immature spirit going on to their next home where there's a kindergarten that's a little more friendly and balanced, and a strong service to other soul walking into that body. Lots of people will comment that someone has had a sudden change, someone they know, different, they have more resolve, they're kinder. And what caused this change? It might be that they've become a walk-in. Well, what happens to the service to self? Are their numbers decimating on Earth at this time? You bet. The reason for this, this is not their future home. If we have a strongly service to a self person who dies and their incarnation is at an end, they're not going to be allowed to cycle back into the earth. They're sent off to one of those orphanages to be born on a service to self world where they'll experience those leveling wars, living in hell, living with each other for the first time. So this really creates an environment here on earth where we're having an increasing percentage of service to other. At present, it's about a little less than 30% service to other, about 5-6% service to self, with all the rest undecided, having not made their decision as to which way they're going to go, young souls. But this percentage is going to increasingly grow in the service to other arena. After the pole shift, the percentages will be about the same. Perhaps a few more service to other because they are given an assist at the moment of the pole shift, commonly called the lift, and which Christians refer to as the rapture. But this is not based on following church rules, but based on whether you practice the golden rule sincerely and have done so in the past. Then you might be assisted to survive the pole shift because it's to be your future home. But we still have a very small percentage of service to other on earth compared with undecideds, and all the humans living through the pole shift, expected to be only 10% of the current population, must live out their lives, their normal lives, their incarnation, before the transformation can be complete. So let's return to where we were at the beginning of the hour, the question of how to discern whether someone approaching your survival camp is a good-hearted person and will roll up their sleeves and pitch in, care for others, be a teammate, or whether they're a user. How do you tell? How can people determine, living in a survival camp, whether people approaching it are good-hearted or are they out to be waited on hand and foot?
Well, as you see a group approaching, you might want to observe who's in the lead. Are the men well cared for and robust and striding in front while the stragglers behind seem forlorn and uncared for? Or is the reverse true, where perhaps the men are in the rear and taking care, watchful eye over the ones in front, and the children are being cared for? But if there are no children and it's mostly men, what is their attitude.
I've noticed that I can often tell after a few minutes, it's almost like a vibe coming off of people that if they are self-centered, they get irritated when they're frustrated. People around them, if they're the bully, people will flinch or step back or not children coming up and want to clamber into their parents' arms. They're curious. A parent that is a bully or abusive will swat them away instead of picking them up and holding them. Sometimes you can just tell by spending a few minutes and talking. It comes out from that kind of body language.
The children, if there's children present, that's a great indicator of what kind of relationship these parents provide, whether they're instructing them or and consoling them, and a strong family unit, or you know, whether or not it's a blood family unit, just a strong unit.
Yeah, I've often noticed grocery stores or in parking lots, you can almost determine by looking at a family if there's an abusive relationship. If the adults are well-fed and the children are not, or let's say the guys in the group are well-fed and everybody else looks like they're about to pass out from lack of food, you got a real strong indicator there. And sometimes they say that when people lie, you can also notice that they get shifty-eyed and the like, or they start crossing each other up. One thing that Tex was noticing was asking people to do work really draws out whether they're willing to roll up their sleeves and do the yucky work, or whether they want to be waited on hand and foot.
If they readily agree to do this and seem just profoundly glad to have a place to stop and rest, whether or not it's overnight or as long as they need to.
And I've noticed, too, that whether people volunteer or not, now, of course, somebody who's bent on making a good entree, they'll walk up and they'll offer to do hard work and the like, but after a while that peters off. As soon as they've got their foot in the door, then they'll slack back. But what I've noticed is people will see it needs to be done and just pick up and do it. They don't wait to be assigned the chore. They don't wait to be reminded that this needs to be done. They see it needs to be done, and often they'll do it without even expecting a thank you, just because it needs to be done. You've mentioned something interesting, that in looking at the group, if there's someone injured, a cripple for instance, have they been left in a ditch somewhere, or are they trying to bring them along in a wheelchair or on their backs? How do they treat people that really could be considered discards? They have injured people with them that they're caring for. That's an indicator that they are willing to sacrifice their own pace or share their food and the like for another person, even though that person may not be quote-unquote useful to them at the moment.
Yeah, I think it comes from love and respect. They like to be around them and care for them. It makes them feel whole, and giving seems to be the most important thing.
You mentioned also something about taking a look at them from the distance and trying to gauge what their orientation is, whether they're giving or users, expecting to be waited on hand and foot. Sometimes you can tell from the appearance of a group. You might even, if they don't think they're being watched, you might even see strong members of the group abusing the weak and mistreating them, where they put an act on if they knew they were being watched. So I would guess having a lookout to where people could see who's coming and approaching, watching how they behave with each other, would be a real clue.
With the polarization, there'll be a lot more mental telepathy, and watching the shifty eyes, feel how the handshake is, get a real grasp for what these people are all about. And seeing them from a distance, like you say, too, they'll do things they wouldn't ordinarily do if they thought they were being watched, if they're not of good heart. If they are, then you'll see them as they are.
The Zetas have often used the analogy Yoda, you know, as a highly service to other person, but he's gruff and irritable, and he's always losing his temper with Luke, for instance. But that doesn't mean he's not STO, because his actions and what he's concerned about show what his orientation is. So just because somebody's gruff, or just because somebody who's selfish might be suave and charming, look in your eye, shake your hand, it's difficult from a long distance.
have unconditional love, but that doesn't mean you can allow others to be destructive and walk over you. And just like Yoda appears to be one way and is so wholeheartedly the opposite, you'll have people that will be the reverse. You know, we'll assume to be very smooth, and under the surface, though, you'll see them react otherwise.
I've even noticed that sometimes people who unquestionably STO, sometimes these people just don't get along. They're like oil and water. They argue about what the best approach is. And that's not an indication that one is good-hearted and the other is not. It's just, I think, from what I've heard from the Vedas, that this even occurs in advanced service to other communities where they do have differences of opinion, which is why they have to have the Council of Worlds to settle some of these differences of opinion. And everybody thinks they're doing the right thing. There's just disagreements on the approach, huh?
Yeah, and there can be more than one solution to a problem or a way to approach it, like you say. It doesn't mean that it can't be worked out, but come at it from different... You'll have people with different personalities, different needs.
Yeah, sometimes expectations. I would imagine after the pole shift and people coming together in a setting where they don't have the conveniences, can't take their dry cleaning to be done, don't have wash machines, can't buy groceries at the grocery store, everybody is going to have to do things that they haven't done before and put up with inconveniences, injuries, rashes, mosquitoes, maybe we don't have enough mosquito netting, a lot of irritability, and it requires that people really have a mindset and say, life is not like it used to be, and what I was used to doing, doctor, lawyer, whatever, chieftain, I may not be able to have that role. I may be the person who chops wood or takes out the potty and empties it. If that's what needs to be done because I'm strongest, then that's what I do, and I don't complain about this to others. But there'll be an adjustment period, I would imagine, when people are just furious and upset and confused, and that doesn't mean they're not good-hearted. That just means they're reacting in shock.
Yes, and that probably won't be the entire picture, though. I foresee that people will also find time to realize that they survived, and there's a future, and there are more good-hearted people, and be able to sing and dance and entertain each other with stories and listen to each other if we do feel really upset, or long walks together, or whatever there's time and energy for, working out ways to dry the clothes or cook the meals or clean or whatever needs to be done, you know, patching up the shelter, just working together and appreciating each other and remembering the glass is half full.
I actually had a chance when I moved here to central Wisconsin from California to test that out, that if everybody had the right mindset and was strongly service to other and determined to help mankind in general. We were running a lot of nonprofit projects here at my home, and I had a couple guests. One was a guy from Texas, a firm Republican, used to men running the household. He was staying in my house where I was the matriarch. I'm a firm Democrat. Then we had a gentleman from Japan where the whole culture was different. And the amazing thing is, we all got along. It was a matter of heads together for 5 minutes in the morning on what needed to be done. If one of us needed help, the others just said, I'll do that, jump right in. And it was, I think, to me, an example of not punching the time clock, but just doing what needs to be done. And it worked terrifically well. We all agreed on what needed to be done, you know, the tasks that needed to be done.
Sounds like an accidental experiment in the aftertime. Everyone gets a chance to flower and to show their true worth. And the thing about being a survivor is you'll be so busy doing just that that the work will keep you busy. You'll find talents you didn't know you had, and you'll be exhausted, and it'll be well worth it. You won't worry about being a lawyer or an accountant. You'll be relieved of that.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future.